Well, a limited instruction can occur at the time the evidence is admitted or in the jury charge itself. And in this case, appellant's trial counsel did not request one at either point, and the trial court failed to instruct the jury. So the effect of that stipulation coming in was that this jury had no choice other than to use the stipulation as evidence of whether or not appellant was guilty of the underlying offense. And beg your pardon?
To make it worse, the prosecutor, as I recall, argued.
Actually, the prosecutor did.
And they should consider it as evidence of guilt.
I'm going to address that, Your Honor, when I talk about the harm analysis, but you're absolutely right. The prosecutor did make reference to the stipulation. Martin versus State, I believe, is dispositive of this case, and the State and I disagree regarding the holding in Martin. We believe Martin absolutely, unequivocally, and unambiguously held that the jury charge must inform the jury of the existence of prior convictions used for enhancement stipulated by the defendant. So there is must language in Martin. Additionally, Martin held in plain, simple, and direct language, quote, the trial court errs in submitting a jury charge that contains neither a reference to the jurisdictionally required prior convictions nor any reference to the defendant's stipulation. So we believe, based on Martin, that we've got error in this case, and the only issue is egregious harm, because the use of prior convictions for enhancement purposes must be buffered with a limited instruction. Otherwise, juries are free to consider prior convictions as evidence of guilt in the underlying charge. The harm analysis, we've got four factors to consider. Number one is the charge as a whole, two, the state of the evidence, three, arguments of counsel, and four, any other relevant information. And regarding the harm analysis, the brief does an extensive analysis regarding all four of those factors. I'd like to highlight just a few as they relate to each of those four points. Regarding the charge, the jury charge in this case made specific reference to the prior conviction. And in the absence of any limiting instruction, the jury had no choice but to consider the prior conviction in deciding whether or not appellant was guilty or not. So the first factor, we submit, must be resolved in appellant's favor. The second factor, that is the state of the evidence, at best that's neutral for the state, because there was evidence that she was assaulted. There was also evidence that she wasn't. Because the jury returned a finding of guilt in this case, I'm going to say that factor at best is neutral for the state.
Okay, talking about that factor, the charge was that the assault was by choking, grabbing or choking, right?
They could have alleged choking, Judge. But in this case, they had that option, and I'll go back and verify that in just a moment. But regarding the state of the evidence, there was evidence of choking, but I'm going to go back and answer that in rebuttal. The third factor has to be resolved in appellant's favor completely, and this is what you were talking about, Judge Dolfino. In closing argument, the prosecutor made the following remarks, and it's quoted in the brief. Number one, for this to be a felony, there has to be a prior conviction for family violence. State's exhibit number 11 right there. So that's what that is. I don't know if it was introduced to y'all or not, but this is state's exhibit number 11. It's been introduced into evidence. It's the stipulation showing he is the same Stephen Bishop that was convicted in that prior that he pled to when we read the indictment to y'all at the beginning of trial this morning. So there is specific reference in the prosecutor's remarks when he's talking about why they should find him guilty, and he's referring to that stipulation. The fourth factor is a little bit more difficult, and there's a number of different points that need to be discussed, and we recognize that in jury selection, the state did correctly inform the jury that a prior conviction cannot be used as evidence of guilt. The prosecutor absolutely made those remarks in jury selection, and in closing argument, appellant's trial counsel made those same statements to the jury. But neither of those situations is enough to overcome the prosecutor's specific remarks and other portions of the charge. In the other portions of the charge that are relevant, the trial court specifically instructed the jury that statements of counsel are not evidence. Moreover, the trial court instructed the jury that they were required to consider and discuss only the facts and circumstances that were admitted into evidence. And in this case, we've got a stipulation regarding a prior conviction without a limitation telling the jury, you're allowed to consider this for all purposes. So because of that, we believe that there was egregious harm in this case, and I want to distinguish this case from Martin. Martin's distinguishable in at least four respects. Number one, in Martin, the stipulation to the prior DWI convictions were not admitted in the guilt phase of trial. Those stipulations were only admitted in the punishment phase. Number two, in Martin, in the guilt phase, the jury was instructed only on a misdemeanor driving while intoxicated case. There was no reference whatsoever in Martin regarding the use of any prior convictions. The fourth factor, in Martin, the court made specific reference that the jury charge actually benefited Martin because it had no reference whatsoever to prior convictions. So the state cannot use Martin to say that it's a case that represents that egregious harm should not be found in this case. So in summary, in appellant's case, stipulations admitted into evidence, the jury charge specifically instructs the jury to consider all the facts that were admitted. There's no limiting instruction whatsoever, and in this case, egregious harm did occur.
I'm going to read you the application paragraph, just a short, just applicable portion of it. Cause bodily injury by grabbing, choking, and strangling. So, what was the evidence of choking and strangling? And then I'll tell you why I'm asking you a little bit.
There was evidence in the record that she had red marks on her neck. There was some testimony that she was choked, but there was also evidence that the red marks were formed by stress and that it wasn't by application of the defendant's hand to her throat. So in that indictment, in that application paragraph, the grabbing part, the grabbing, choking, or strangling.
No, not or. And. But,
beg your pardon?
Not or. And.
Okay.
In the application paragraph, you can plead in the conjunctive and charge in the disjunctive. But here, they pled in the conjunctive and charged in the conjunctive. I think you have to prove all of them, grabbing and choking and strangling.
I think you're absolutely right. If it's charged in the conjunctive, that's correct. We didn't challenge the sufficiency of the evidence because there was some evidence to support the verdict in this case.
Okay. What was the evidence of choking and strangling? Was it that she didn't remember because it happened so fast? Is that where that came in? Or who testified to the choking and strangling?
If you'll give me a moment, Judge, I'd like to answer that in rebuttal. I didn't prepare to argue sufficiency, but I've got that documented in my brief.
Well, I'm really not looking at this as sufficiency so much as harm.
Okay. As it relates to harm,
the evidence is weak or non-existent, and they still convict. I think that's something we look at in the egregious.
As far as the strength of the evidence, you're exactly correct, and I'll come back and answer that specifically in just a moment.
Thank you, Mr. Hagan. Ms. Left.
May it please the court, counsel.
Can you help me out here, Kath?
Yes, I am, Your Honor. First of all, you asked about how he was charged. He was charged under 2201 B-A, and more recently, actually right before this offense, the statute was changed to include impeding of normal breathing, but that's not how the state charged in this case. the evidence to show grabbing, choking, and strangling. That came in several different ways. There were three different people who testified to what the victim told them right after the offense, that she had been, and I hadn't thought about it in this light, so I'm not remembering the exact words, but that she had been choked, and at least two of those people said that she had passed out as a result of that, that she said she'd lost consciousness. She also, I believe, admitted it at one point, and then she went back and forth, but the evidence shows that she was just scared to death of the defendant, and she was changing her story. She eventually came in and testified as to what happened. The state's position is that the trial court did not err, not including the limiting instruction in the charge. The defendant didn't request it. Martin simply said that that was at least one approved method of charging the jury on a stipulation that it would include a limiting instruction. They gave a non-exclusive list of ways to charge. And the state's position that his appellate was not egregiously harmed by the lack of a limiting instruction. As Your Honor noticed, during voir dire, the state went overboard in telling the jurors you may not consider this as evidence of guilt in the instant case. And in closing arguments, the defense counsel reinforced what the state had said. Again, the evidence here was strong, supporting appellant's guilt.
But the court never told them it wasn't evidence of guilt, and the court instructed them to consider all the evidence, and the prosecutor argued that they should consider the prior conviction as evidence of guilt. But also, if it's admitted without a limiting instruction, because it's jurisdictional, is it in for all purposes, or is it in only for jurisdictional purposes?
I think when it's not objected to, from what the case law I've read, it might be in for all purposes. But I still think, in closing argument, I disagree with counsel. The prosecutor was not asking the jurors to use the prior as evidence of guilt. He was simply showing the jurors how the state met its burden of proof as the prior was referenced in the application paragraph. And if you look at the surrounding language, you'll see that was all he was doing. He was going through what we had to prove. This is a good prosecutor. He was not trying to have the jury consider that as evidence of guilt in this case. He was expressly trying to have the jury not do that. Appellant now seems to argue, and I just, under this point of error in his brief, I just got that he's complaining about the limiting instruction. Now he points to wording in Martin that a jury should be instructed about the existence and the effect of the priors, or prior in this case. I think the jury was instructed as to the effect. I don't remember that the jury was instructed in the charge as to the existence of the stipulation, but one of the cases I cited, it's an unpublished opinion out of Dallas, Grisby. They discussed the harm in that, and they said such error would not be egregiously harmful. And they noticed two reasons. They said, first, that reduced the number of references to the stipulation by not including it, and also it permitted the jury to acquit, and this is what we had in our case, acquit appellant if it wasn't convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that he committed the prior offense. And that's the same language we had in our charge. So unless there are any questions, the state will conclude.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Leff.
Thank you.
Mr. Hagan, rebuttal.
Judge, the primary evidence regarding the choking came from her testimony. And at the scene, she demonstrated to Officer Luce that the red marks were consistent with, you know, being choked. There's evidence of that, but again, there's also evidence that it didn't happen. So I submit the state of the evidence, while sufficient to support a conviction, is at best neutral when conducting a harm analysis as it relates to the absence of the charge to include that limited instruction. I want to make reference to the arguments of counsel because I think that's critical in this case. And the prosecutor in this case is very experienced and very skilled, and while the prosecutor and jury selection did the right thing, prosecutor was very clever how he couched his argument in closing. Because here the prosecutor, and it's stated on page 21 of our brief, says, based on the evidence, he's guilty. There's no question he's guilty. I'm going to walk through with you why he's guilty. And then number one, for this to be a felony, there has to be a prior conviction. So he talks about it, but he's clever enough not to reference you can't consider it. And the charge as a whole, when it's admitted for all purposes, says they can consider it for any reason whatsoever. So we've got not only harm, but in this case, under the facts of this case, egregious harm. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hagan. Thank you, Ms. Love. We appreciate your arguments and coming to Fort Worth today. Your case is submitted, and you all are excused. If the clerk will now adjourn court, please.
All right.
The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District is now adjourned.